Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Julie Hanna. I'm going to moderate this panel. And since you all have the books and the bios, I'll let everyone introduce themselves briefly. And then if you guys, when you, as we go along the discussion, if you can just talk about the part of your background that's sort of to give some context to this topic. That would be meaningful. And then I also have a mystery guest with us, Mark Tarpanin, who is not on the agenda. I drafted Mark. He's the founder of Tesla Motors and has some great experience on this topic. So why don't we start with you, Toby?
I'm Toby Pren. I have a company called G2 Energy, which is a green energy company. I've started about 15 businesses in various fields. Primarily in specialty finance, but also in other areas like energy.
So, Mark Tarpanin, and my first company was electronic books, very much like the Kindle is now, if you're familiar with that, where we partnered with a bunch of very large publishing houses. And then more recently, I'm the co-founder of Tesla Motors, which some of you probably are aware, it's an electric race sports car company, with an operation in Hethel, England. So, and that... The car companies are all about partnering.
Sounds good. Interesting. Bob Cart, founder and chairman of GreenVolts, a solar technology company building solar equipment for utility scale to reach or beat the price of fossil fuel energy. In terms of partnering, as I started, my first foray into business, I think, was the smallest LBO in history. So I borrowed $40,000 against some sewing machines for a belt and suspender factory. And then from there, I've done several acquisitions and mergers of small companies and mergers at large company, as well as various business partnerships. It's a broad range of things when you say talk about partnering with people. Could mean a lot.
Is that literally a belt and suspender factory?
Literally. Well, actually it was belts first, and I broadened the line into braces.
I'm Ash Javeri. I'm at Google, and I run one of our partnerships teams that focuses on channel partners. So kind of all I do every day is think about partnerships. Spent also time at Microsoft before, so I kind of have the big company experience and views of partnerships. And before that, I was at a startup for about 6 years where we were actually trying to partner with big companies like IBM and NCR and that type of thing. So kind of have perspective from the inside now and also perspective as kind of a small company.
Thank you. Welcome. And I just realized I didn't introduce my background. So I'm a serial entrepreneur. I spent a good part of my career in sort of dancing in the shadow of Microsoft. In the messaging space, my last company is a company called Scalix, which was an open source alternative to Microsoft Exchange. And so that's, I guess, probably the most... And then also sold a company to Netscape in the late 90s, which is also a competitor in the Microsoft Lotus field. So that's the perspective I bring. So I think we have three clean tech folks... One incumbent with startup background. I'll represent the tech startup view, maybe, as I moderate. So the topic, let's just dive right in. Going after or partnering with incumbents, good strategy or fool's errand. So when is it a good idea to go after the incumbent, and when is it a better idea to try to partner, and when is it a good idea to just ignore them altogether? Anybody?
I'll start, I guess. Oftentimes in business, when you look at especially large bureaucratic organizations, evolution of business concepts happens in a very choppy fashion. It's often referred to as co-evolution, where something changes, and that results in something else changes, and that results in something else changes. And a lot of times, large bureaucratic organizations miss those opportunities that result from co-evolution. So my experience has been, as things are changing, to find an area that I've often referred to as being in the shadow of the spotlight of a large organization, where they're not seeing the opportunity, seize that opportunity, take advantage of it, make a profitable company, and then often sell that enterprise to the incumbent. because it really fits within their larger business focus, but they're, you know, they've missed this opportunity that was right under their feet.
So focusing on an underserved market that might be compatible with the business the incumbent is in?
Exactly.
Yeah, and just to chime in, I think partnering itself, what does that mean? It's a very, you know, in a legal sense, you have a partnership, and that means something very specific. It could mean an all-out merger of two companies. It could be an acquisition called a partnership. It could be just a matter of the mainline business of how commercial operations happen. So, for example, we sell our product to ABC Company, who then resells, so they're really a distributor, and we call that a partnership, but we've got a team, and we actually don't, I'm just using that as an example, a team of 50 people who are doing those partnerships. It's not, what is that really a partnership or just part of the mainline business? So I think when the concept of partnership is most interesting is when it hasn't been done before, it's not a standard part of the business, and you're trying to decide how to provide some value and receive some value in a unique way that builds both both firms, makes them both stronger. And those deals are really complicated often because it's something different. The company's not organized around doing that type of deal. And you start to deal with cultural issues, with two different cultures of the companies, different products, different motivations. And it can be a real drain, and it can also be really powerful.
I want to drill in on something you just said that's really key. It's implicit in what you said, sort of that unique, and has to do with this sort of unique partnership. I think so much of this has to do with knowing intimately well the company you want to potentially partner and understanding the underlying motivations from the inside looking out. It's very easy to look from the outside looking and say, well, you know, Google should be doing this. We're going to do that. We're the best thing that could ever happen to them, versus really understanding what is Google's strategy and how are they viewing the world from the outside, inside looking out. Mark, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, sometimes the incumbents have something that they're not taking advantage of at all. So in my first company, we were looking at how to get reading material, you know, monetize that on the web somehow, actually being able to charge for it. So the incumbents had all of the copyrighted material. So you had to do a partnership. There wasn't any other way. So for that, in that case, we were really looking, we said, you know, you have this asset you're not using, and we want to enable you to use that. And so we were able to come up with partnerships for all the publishers. But it was something that they had that they weren't using, and to them it was incremental revenue. Now, there was lots of issues internally in the politics of those companies, but those partnerships actually worked because they could sort of see how that was going to be beneficial to them, and obviously it was beneficial to us because we got the content, which is what we needed.
I think to your point of sort of the internal politics, right? I mean, all big companies, probably even small companies at some level, have a level of politics, but when you're working with a big company, I think the question is, are you able to find somebody who's actually your advocate, first of all, you know, somebody who sees the value in the partnership and is willing to fight for it, because there is a lot of fighting, whether it's a big company or a small company. A lot of the fighting happens internally. Do you have that advocate that not only has the passion but also has the ability to actually get something done, or is he going to get mired in 45 different reviews and processes and then sort of end up losing the passion or the desire to get the deal forward? And I found that, you know, both viewing kind of various deals internally and also having tried to partner with IBM in various capacities, you know, if you can't find that advocate and if you can't find that person who really is going to basically make a career on this, it might be very difficult.
Yeah, that's a great segue. You know, you often hear about this internal champion who is sort of helping navigate a potential partner in the company and the politics of, I'd love to hear you guys comment on this, sort of there's the politics of the organization and then there's the politics of the champion, you know, sort of, and the, what motivates the champion and is one way to really get insight into whether this champion could be effective in the organization. Can they make stuff happen? What's motivating them to be a hero? Are they inclined to take risk or not? You know, so I'd love to hear kind of your comments and thoughts and experiences on the champion.
Yeah, so I think the champion is just absolutely critical. Great point. Without that, it's really even, you know, questionable that you should try to do it. And one of the things implied in kind of the title here about incumbency is you're probably smaller and newer. They're entrenched. And so your culture may be much more innovative, much more diverse, change directions easily, whatever goes, let's go that way, that's the best way, and everybody piles on. A big organization, it's much harder to change direction quickly. And if the champion recognizes that and says, hey, we really like your product, your segment, your capability, we're so big, we can't do it. We would love to, and I have support of the senior management, if I'm not senior management, to bring that in. I think it's such a fallacy when you hear as a small company, I hear this all the time, why are you doing that? Isn't General Electric or Exxon or Total or someone going to just do that and take it over? And the fact is they can't do it. They can't figure it out. They're too big and diverse, and so they very much need the types of technologies, types of businesses that the smaller startup might create. But the champion has to recognize that and be able to communicate that internally to convince you that, you know, it will happen.
Absolutely.
Can we add a bit of fine grained detail on this notion of the champion? Because as an entrepreneur going into a large company, you know, the person you meet might appear like a champion. Is actually just a low-level gatekeeper, and nobody's really going to own up to the fact they're not the champion.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the ritualistic, you know, the coffee, the teapot in the middle of the table, the plate of biscuits, and you go in there, and all the soups are out there. So, how would you advise young entrepreneurs to separate out the gatekeeper and some personal anecdotes of maybe strategies you've used would be helpful?
So the question is how to kind of discern whether you're dealing with someone who has the potential to be a champion versus a low-level gatekeeper
who
thinks of themselves as a champion, who's really qualified to be a champion versus who's someone who thinks of themselves as being a champion. How do you suss that out? Any experiences you'd like to share that would help?
Sure. I'm happy to. So in the publishing industry, very quickly we discovered that all of the low-level people that we could get to, that industry at the time was so fossilized that there was no possible champion within the organization that we could get at. So we went at it the other way and recruited a person from the publishing industry that was very, very well respected, and just did a, you know, full court press on her to get her on our board of directors. And she was kind of tickled to be in the Silicon Valley sort of new age thing, kind of. But her connections then, suddenly we were dealing with only the CEOs of Bertelsmann and of Random House and stuff. And that completely changed the dynamic. But we had tried to find somebody internally and couldn't. So we had to use a different strategy to get around that. And those people are quite approachable if you have a compelling enough idea.
I think also, you know, if you're sitting down with somebody from a big company, there's probably a few things you can do. One, you know, with LinkedIn or something like that, you can actually kind of look at the person you're meeting with their bio, right? So you might be able to tell if they've been around for 20 years. There's a plus and a minus to that, right? You know, what have they sort of done? Is there sort of some track record that you can just educate yourself on before you meet? But I think if you're sitting down with people and you hear a lot of words like this is our policy and this is our process and sort of, you know, a lot of kind of flags coming up right away around, well, this is how we do things versus an active dialogue of let's figure out what the right thing to do and bring that forward is, that could also be a telltale sign that you might not be working with the right person.
Bob or Toby, would you add anything to that?
I have an interesting war story that I'm not sure how relevant it is to something any of you might do in your futures, but it's been instructive for me, I guess. I had a partnership with a large company, a Fortune 100 company, and the partnership I had was, the champion for me was the president of the company, and that company, the executive suite was split between the president and the CEO. And part of what the president recognized was the innovative approach we were taking to an asset that was in this company that they didn't understand how to create value from that asset. And so we put together a team and spent a couple of years creating, you know, something pretty interesting. And then, unrelated to us, there was a fight between the president and the CEO. Board kicked the president out, so now we didn't have a champion. And during that two-year period, the mistake that we made was, because we thought we were dealing at very high levels in the company, we didn't play politics. We had really been very separate from how the rest of the organization was working. We were really trying to be innovative in this product that we were creating. Well, when our champion left, all of a sudden all these middle-level managers started to swoop in on our group, and it was amazing. We were doing something that had never been done before. Really, in my estimation, a very hard-to-figure-out technology that we created. But in hindsight, all these middle-level managers, their opinion was, well, that was an obvious thing to do. Of course we created that. It was an asset that we already had. You guys just recombined stuff that was already existing in the company. Therefore, it's unfair that you have this partnership relationship with us. We want to change the terms of that. So it was a very painful process, and I think it's something I would have structured the deal quite differently in hindsight, of course.
So another thing on this is, how do you find the champion, and who is the champion, and how does that work? And I think you've got to know, for the deal that you're proposing or being proposed, who makes the decision. Is it that individual, and do you know that? Checking history, seeing if they've done that before. Is it part of the mainline business? For example, if you're selling a product to a retail store and there's a buyer, and you may call your deal a partnership, they're just buying product. Even if it's a special placement and a promotion, all of that, that's not a partnership. That's a trade sale. In some cases, if you had a contact with the CEO or top person, they're not the right ones. You need that buyer. That's who's going to make the decision. Same thing happens a lot in politics, at least in the U.S. If you go speak with a representative from Congress or a senator, they can't do anything. They just show up and shake hands and smile. It's their staffers who actually write the laws and make things happen. So, however, at another level, the CEO or president may not be the decision maker. It may be a board level thing. When you start talking about deeper level partnerships or structures, there's actually a sell job to the board members. How do you get your story to the board members and get a broader support? And so whenever you have a deal that requires more than a single person, and especially in different kind of like board and executive management, it gets really difficult. And the champion that you have in that needs to be able to explain to you, this board member can sway these board members, and the CEO is not aligned with this person. And really, if you're getting that kind of feedback, then you should feel pretty good about the possibilities.
Actually, you just said something key. You've all kind of triggered some thoughts here. So the champion isn't the decision maker. So that's one thing. I don't know if it may, just to tease that out, the champion, one of the key sort of traits of a champion I found is that they understand the workings of the organization. They can be your eyes and ears for educating you about things like Bob was just talking about. This, and so one of the key things in sussing this out, I find, actually I'm on the board of a company right now that is getting a lot of interest from big companies like IBM. It's a state of mind and a psychology that it's important for the company to assume, to go in and move from this breathy excitement of IBM's called, they're interested in talking to us, let's just go tell them what we're doing, get them excited, to asking a lot of questions, to going and asking questions what's the process, what's the decision-making process, how's this tied to this, to really understand, is this somebody's pet project, is this R&D kicking the tires and getting you to educate them, or is this of strategic importance to the company, and what's the sense of urgency? And oftentimes the champion can be the low-level gatekeeper, actually, if they have enough intelligence in the organization. The other thing that was alluded to here that I just want to punctuate is the stakeholder point, that if it's something of any significance, you've got multiple stakeholders. And stakeholders don't always correlate by title or level in the organization. Inevitably, with I've repeatedly been in situations where the CEO was very excited about something, wanted to push it through, and the sysadmin would sabotage it because they weren't bought in and we hadn't paid enough attention to them. And they could come up with all the reasons for why, you know, this is going to blow this up or whatever, and management gets afraid and says, oh, wait a minute, you know. When Toby talked about having the president and sort of paying, we've made that same mistake as well. So you say, okay, we've got our champion. They can make a decision. This is the CIO. This is the CTO. Not paid enough attention to stakeholders around it. These long cycles kick in. The person changes jobs. They leave the company. And then you're an island. And everybody says, oh, yeah, that was that pet project. So I just wanted to punctuate some great points you guys are making.
I'd like to make one point is that the stakeholders, what you said is so true, but you can also, those can change during the negotiations. So, for instance, at Lotus, we came in, we frankly needed the relationship with Lotus because they could manufacture cars for us, the actual car part. And that was something we really couldn't do. And it turned out they were a really good partner, and we really wanted them, but we couldn't let them know that, of course. So we had come in through the business development group because we knew that they were hunting for more business. Lotus is always on the edge financially, and they had just lost a contract, which we had read about, so we thought, this is our opportunity. But as we got more into the operation, we discovered that one of the key people manufacturing is really important to Lotus. That's what employs everybody. So the guy who runs the factory, who never meets with external people, he has to be, if he's enthusiastic about it, then it's going to happen. So when we learned that one of the Opel programs was coming to an end, we made sure we approached him, you know, how we ended up meeting him, but we made sure to explain that, well, you know, our volumes would fill in that manufacturing niche. And that converted him into somebody who would be kind of resistant because it's a change to being somebody who was bought in a big way and could sit there every time he'd meet with the CEO saying, hey, you know, we have this problem coming up and we're going to have this volume drop and we're going to have to lay some people off. You know, that Tesla thing, have you looked into that? And that really helped you make the deal happen because we had this advocate, this other sort of, not a champion, but this other advocate who, it met his business need. And we kept expanding that until finally, you know, we got the deal.
So we've been talking about partnering quite a bit. I'd like to ask your thoughts about when is it a good idea to just go after the incumbent and compete with them, either head on or indirectly?
Always.
Good, a fighter. Always, okay?
That's most of what I've done in my business career, is to find an underserved area within, you know, as an example, I was in the, I've done a lot of banking work, and about 10 years ago, we discovered a niche that was being underserved, which was making loans to people who wanted to buy corporate aircraft. And there was a segment of that, those potential borrowers that were being overlooked by the banking industry. So the underserved niche was people who wanted to borrow a relatively small amount against the airplane, which from a lender's perspective means it's a really safe loan, but didn't want to sign personal guarantees. Well, if you went to all the major banks, it didn't matter whether they would lend you 90% against the airplane, but if you only wanted to borrow 50%, they still required personal guarantees. What we said is, it's a safer loan to make the 50% loan to value and not get the personal guarantee. So it opened up that whole segment of the market that was being just not even paid attention to by the banking sector. Now, after we built that business, we sold it to a bank. And we sold it to a bank because they said, wow, these people who buy these $10 or $20 million airplanes, our customers, we want to have the bank. So it was a way for a medium-sized bank to attract a large group of very influential clients. So it was a, you know, an underserved market that we took advantage of and then sold right back to the group that was underserving the market.
Well, it's hard to compete in the car industry head on with those guys. But you always want them to keep themselves, you always want to worry them a little bit, see if they're really business, which is why Daimler, I think, you know, they were flailing and they bought part of Tesla Motors, I think, largely because they were getting worried in a particular niche. I don't know if you can really go after somebody that big, but I like this idea of finding these niches and then selling them into the...
How many of you have read Innovator's Dilemma or are familiar with that book? Hands, show hands. Okay. So Innovator's Dilemma talks about... I would highly recommend it if this is a subject that's of high importance to you. It talks a lot about finding success in an underserved market and then kind of working your way up. And then gradually you become more relevant in the market. But I think something implicit with the always statement and the underserved market statement is that I've sometimes heard entrepreneurs talk about the basis of what they're doing being dependent on a partnership for success. And that's a very vulnerable strategy. You want to have in-market success directly, and your strategy be based on that, and then you become attractive as a potential partner or a competitor in your own right.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, when I talk about going head-on, your big company probably has diverse products and different things going on, and you don't necessarily go after all of that. You pick some area that you're focused on. And I think with regard to that, having a successful commercial operation, growing, all of the right things, that's when you have strength. It doesn't matter what size, but as long as things are moving in the right direction, then you have an opportunity in a partnership or to sustain yourself. You've got a lot of leverage. And when it starts feeling the other way, it's a disproportionate downslide versus the disproportionate upside. So it's really key to make sure that you've got a kind of sustaining ongoing business without needing the partnership, or at least every perception of that, and really make sure you've backstopped it to do that.
So Ash, we've been talking a lot about from the small company sort of appealing to the incumbent. Maybe you can share some thoughts from the incumbent's perspective as to what draws your attention to companies in the market and say, hey, you know, we'd like to work with them. You know, what are some of the markers there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. First of all, a big company is a big company, and it's actually a federation of a lot of different small companies, right? So whether you're at Microsoft and you're working at Microsoft, or you're at Google and you're working at Google, you and a different employee within the same company, potentially within the same office even, can have a whole different set of experiences, a whole different sort of set of credibility things that you can do. And this is why, you know, I think, not to sort of belabor the point of having the right champion and having the right part in the organization matters a lot. From a Google perspective, what we really look for, I mean, there's a couple things. One is just, is it a great user experience? You know, first of all, everything we do is absolutely always focused on user experience first and foremost. Is it scalable, right? Number two is you've got a great user experience, but can this scale? Everything we sort of look at and everything we do is around scale, and does this have the potential to scale? Right? Is there something that Google, through its assets of data centers and things like this, can actually build to help grow this business? I mean, if you look at YouTube, for instance, I think something like 20 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute or something. I mean, that number might even be higher now. That's something where we can bring our data centers, we can bring all of the sort of engineering knowledge that we have to take a business that we think is a good idea and really scale it. It started off with a good user experience, and, you know, we've been able to really blow it up based on a lot of the assets that we have.
So just a follow-on question to that. So if this was an audience of aspiring entrepreneurs that wanted to engage in talks with Google, what advice would you have for them?
The first thing I'd say is don't don't build your business, or don't try to build a business to get acquired by Google or by Microsoft or sort of by anyone. Right? I think what Bob was saying, you want to have a standalone business first. I mean, don't come out of the gate saying, hey, we're going to build something because Google isn't doing it today, and you know, they'll acquire us, because chances are we might also be working on it. I mean, you know, we've got 10,000 engineers that have a lot of free time, you know, 20% time that they can actually go and work on and experiment with stuff. So we've got a lot of different things going on. So I wouldn't necessarily say, hey, I'm going to build this to, you know, go get acquired by Google. I think the other piece, and how do you sort of get that visibility? I think it's you know, there are 20,000 people working there. It's probably should be relatively easy to find somebody either through an alumni network or through a hop and a skip to just start building that relationship. I think you can't start too early in building some of those relationships with sort of all of the companies, right? Not just Google, but you'd want to do it with Microsoft and with IBM and sort of wherever your business generally lies. And you want to sort of be on someone's radar at some point so that when you do hit a few success milestones, you've got a phone to call and you can sort of, you know, continue that conversation inside.
Great advice. So the way you talked about that was implied that it's Google tends to think in terms of acquisition versus partnership. Is that true, or
so
can you comment on that?
I think the piece that I was looking at was more along the lines of acquisition and what do we sort of look for in acquiring companies. You know, I think partnering, you know, sort of the way that we look at the business is, you know, can you bring us scale, right? So we work on big distribution deals. You know, are you doing things that can help us get our products out there, right? We've got nascent products as well, things like Google Chrome, EOS, things like this, that we're going to need help, you know, with people getting it out there, getting the word. You know, if you're a developer, can you help move things forward like HTML5 and standards and things that we're promoting to make the web better and faster? Are you doing things that are even more innovative than we are? Chances are you might very well be doing. You know, is there something that we can do? Is there a resource that we can lend to help you, you know, attack your mission that helps our mission, which is at the end of the day making the web a bigger, faster place?
Okay. So I'm using Google in this case just as a proxy for large companies in general, potential kind of partners and inquiries. And one of the things that is important to also glean is this a company that has a history of partnering, or do they tend to do mostly acquisition? And some of the things he's sharing, the question version, the way to get at what he's sharing through questioning is gives you insight into how that potential kind of partner incumbent thinks and strategizes. But at this point, we have 20 minutes left. Since we do have a small group, why don't we just have more of a Q&A format, and we can just kind of have more discussion. So I'll open it to the floor for any questions. Yes?
Yeah. If you're a small company and you're looking to partner with a big incumbent, what's the best, or what do you need to do in establishing credibility?
Depending on the industry.
Yeah.
So the question is,
how do you establish credibility to go in and partner with a large organization versus a small startup?
Okay, so the question is, how do you establish credibility when you're looking to partner with a large organization?
I have an experience with doing that one time where we were in one of our finance businesses. We sold structured bonds to a large insurance company, and it was a kind of bond that they generally called a story bond, which meant that it was something that really hadn't been done before, an asset class that hadn't really been structured like this before. And so the folks that we sold the bond to, we necessarily had to describe what the components of the bond were. It wasn't just trading off of the rating of the bond. So after having a relationship with the folks that we sold these bonds to for, you know, several years, when we started another company, totally different, one of these large insurance companies that was buying our bonds liked our innovative approach to how we looked at the world. So when we started a completely different company and we needed a certain segment of capital to engage in that business, they were a natural choice to go put that capital in to own an equity stake in the business, to also have a pipeline of investments to make. but it was a you know, it was a way for them to have a relationship with a known group of people and get an equity stake in addition to what they normally get, which is just bonds. But it takes a long time. It took a half a decade to build that relationship.
Another question?
Let me ask Toby a question. How can you switch from being in banking and finance into green? Are you now a carbonist?
You know, I'm probably going to...
Just let me repeat the question for the video.
Yeah,
so the question was for Toby. Why did he switch from being a capitalist to a carbonist? Is that right?
Well, well, first of all, I'm still in the finance business. About 5 or 6 years ago, I became highly critical of the segment of the finance business I was in, which was the securitized lending business, and was a vocal critic of the way deals were being structured on Wall Street. And as a result of that, didn't want to participate anymore because of the disconnect between the investment community and the origination community. So I sold most of my finance businesses, and I'm still in some finance businesses, but not using the securitization exit. And so I'm redeploying some of my personal wealth in other businesses, one of them being green energy. I'm not a carbonist. I'm in green energy because it's a profitable venture for me. Now, do I think it's doing good things? Yes. In our particular brand of green energy, we destroy pollution to make energy. We use a pollutant to make electricity. It also has the benefit of reducing a greenhouse gas. But the reason I'm in the business is because I can make energy for 5 cents a kilowatt, I can sell it for 11 cents a kilowatt. I make the difference. Now, I also get tax credits and all the other things that come with green energy in the United States, but it is purely a business for profit. It's a side benefit is that it may have some environmental benefits.
Yeah, I'd love to comment on that too, given I was having to take the other side of the argument last night, which, by the way, was quite difficult. Being a supporter of the opposition, I think the main point there is that this carbonist idea, which might have been invented last night, I think for that to really happen, there needs to be capitalism. There needs to be returns on the investments made. I don't see how it works otherwise. So that's really it's both things. And in order to build really strong infrastructure, takes a lot of capital. How are you going to get that capital? There's got to be returns.
Yeah, I just want to make one comment on that. I also totally agree. And there was something you said that you're selling energy, you know, at 11 cents and producing it for 5, and there's also all that government stuff that helps. Yet when we structured Tesla, that was what convinced me it was possible to do that particular venture, because I felt we could actually make money selling a high-end sports car. There was money to be made there regardless of what other credits we got. And the credits, if that happens, because any time that you're dependent on government fiat like that for your business strategy, I think that's very dangerous. You know, in Tesla's case, we had a business plan that actually held together fine. And then if we got, in our case, there's zero emissions credits we get, which are actually quite monetizable. But that was not any part of the business plan other than to say, you know, in a footnote, there might be a whole bunch of these government credits we could get that could be great for the balance sheet, but we don't know what, you know, we're not going to count on that.
And a business like Tesla is really a crucible for innovation. You know, is someone buying a $100,000 sports car because they're trying to drive more efficiently and save money on, well, no, they're not.
They're not trying to save money.
But the ultimate result of the Tesla experiment, in my opinion, will be people being able to drive for a fraction of what it costs to put liquid fuels in their car, because electrical energy bought at night when there's very little demand on the grid is a very efficient way for automotive transportation, assuming battery technology works and public utility negotiation happens where individuals can actually buy power when it's less valuable at a lower price. So all those things have to happen, but it takes innovative companies like Tesla to move that ball forward. And takes a long time to get from what should be efficient to what is efficient.
Next question.
Suppose you started, you got this prototype, you really think it's a finalized product, it's great. You want to start partnering. And I think often you get to a point where you say, okay, do you take a small partner first or do you go after the big fish?
Great question.
Do you spend a lot of time trying to catch that big fish or would you rather take a few smaller partners?
So the question is, when you're looking to partner, do you go after the 800-pound gorilla or do you go after smaller partners?
I think the first question you've got to be really careful about asking is why. Why are you partnering? Why are you looking for validation of your prototype that you've put all your heart and soul in? Because if that's what you're looking for, you shouldn't go partner with anyone. If you're looking for... So if you're in a position where you must have, for example, a distribution relationship with a company, whether big or small, you want to pick the best one, the one that has the need, the one that has the capability, the one that will really drive you forward. I mean, I keep that pretty simply. There's always the kind of impression of wow, IBM or some big company that you join with, that means we're really successful. It really doesn't mean that. It's really important to get the fundamentals right first.
And I would also say, on top of that, if you do partner with a big company and you've got a prototype or something that's close to finished, they may pull you in directions that you're just not ready to go. And they may pull you in directions that kind of suit their needs. And if that partnership ends or if it ends badly, or if you want to partner with somebody else, you might have been pulled in a completely different direction than where you started or where you were going to go. So... in some ways, partnering with somebody who is maybe more hungry, you might not get all the distribution in the world, but you might get 40% of it if they're in the same markets and they have the same sort of customers. That might be a better option for you up front and while you're trying to build that credibility. And once you have a set of wins, then you're able to go in a much stronger position, as we were talking about earlier. You don't want to be in a desperation position or needing that partnership with an incumbent. You want to sort of almost have them come to you. And if you can put some wins on the board, they might start noticing you.
That is a great question. We actually spent a lot of time on this. We did a CEO workshop in London before coming here. And one of the things, in my experience, repeatedly, what I found is that the market leader is not as hungry, as motivated. They can take, if there's a disruption or change happening in the market, they can take a wait-and-see attitude. Let's see how this thing matures, evolves, before we do anything. Here, you're the innovator who's part of that disruption. Maybe you're leading it. They'll engage because they want to be educated. They want to track the market. But that's sort of a head fake in terms of a buying sign or a partnering sign. And so sussing that out and qualifying that becomes important. Almost always the tier two guy or the tier three players are much hungrier because they're trying to figure out how to break out and compete. And they're going to take more risks. They're going to move more quickly. They're going to be more aggressive. So I found that it's always more compelling to start at that level. The other thing you touched on, we didn't get into this, and if we have time, I think it would be worthwhile, is partnering with the 800-pound gorilla. I'm reminded of a quote that Steve Jobs has long been credited with, which is that more startups die of indigestion than starvation. And it's a way of saying that, you're sort of trying to drink from a fire hose is another form of saying that. Is that when you can take on too much, and then how do you manage the 800-pound gorilla without being consumed by them, without being completely taken off the rails? It can be really tricky, particularly in the early days. You and then we go. Go to you,
yes. Yeah, so on that note, and as you were describing, sometimes here in the business, we actually have to partner because there's a distribution channel that you want to get to. And, let's say, for example, the automotive business, and you have to deliver to some OEM within that. And you think that you picked the right partner, but how do you actually gauge whether this is the... So once you're in the relationship and you're 3 to 4 months into it, what sort of things can you use to gauge whether this is the right thing or not? Because you don't know if the plane, maybe the here, they look at your technology, and then they think, they feel confident that they'll fix it themselves in the lab. Or
right. Well, you know,
let me just repeat the question
sure.
for the video. So the question is, how do you qualify the opportunity to sort of know whether they're serious, there's a real partnership happening versus education or kicking the tires? Is that?
Yeah.
Or after the fact, after the partnership, is
yeah,
it succeeding?
After the partnership,
you're working with them, but you're not really there yet where you're making money out of it. So how do you make sure that you're not spending a lot of time on something that's
right.
actually bad?
Well, you know, there are different approaches. My approach is to get it all down in writing up front and work that out so that you know what the metrics are, you know what success is, and you work toward that. It's usually a lot more painful to do it that way, and it usually takes a lot longer, and you lose more deals. But you don't have that problem.
And the upside is?
Yeah, the upside is you never have that problem. I mean, it may just fail, but you know what failure is, and it keeps everybody in line.
And, you know, having those metrics or yardsticks into a deal, the more that you can put those in, the internal guy who fought for you at a big company, he doesn't want that deal to necessarily fail or for it to look like a failure. So if you're actually able to quantify success, then you might actually be able to hold him to some of the commitments that he might have made to you during the negotiation process as well.
Yeah. And I'll just add, one other point on that is sometimes you're hungrier by just nature. You can probably figure out what those metrics are with more detail and thought, protecting yourself perhaps than the larger incumbent. Now they may have the same kind of strategy where they're doing things a certain way, but there's more politics, and you're more about, you know, it's complicated, but there's a lot of control that you have in defining those metrics early on and really careful.
I think the metrics are really, really key, and they're all negotiated, I mean, ideally before you get to that execution phase. Because the problem that I see is always in that negotiation phase, are they really planning to ever actually sign the deal, or are they just trying to learn everything that they possibly can? Once the deal is signed, I've actually never had any problem. I mean, other than, you know, things have failed because of one reason or another, but you know that because the metrics are telling you, you know, immediately. But but it's the big danger, I think, for a small company coming in is the head fake, as I said. Are they just trying to learn everything, and then there's no intention to actually sign the deal.
And one technique that's become more commonly used, I know, in the high tech world, as a way of testing the motivation and the commitment, is to ask them to put their money where their mouth is in some way to test the commitment. So early on, you know, we'd like you to come in and do a pilot with us, et cetera, whatever. That used to be thought of by the, you know, sort of, we'll do anything to work with IBM or Microsoft or whatever. We'll spend lots of time. Here's the software. We'll do a pilot, et cetera. That people started to realize this is a drain. We get to nowhere. We kind of get half pregnant with this company, and then we're left kind of standing. And so increasingly, it kind of, I'd probably say 5-8 years ago, there was a growing trend of, okay, you want to do a pilot, once you get to a certain stage, here's a dollar commitment to do the pilot, right? So then you can, if someone's writing a check. Now, an R&D organization that's kicking tires can write a check. It's not a sign of being a strategic partner, but at least they've got some skin in the game. And so that tests the commitment. If they won't do it, then it tells you where they are on that continuum of commitment. Next question.
Yes. So questions so far have assumed that startups have a prototype, at least, of some sort of problem. Let's say that you have a proof of concept, you have some IP, it's very promising, and you go after a large partner saying, you have this, we're still testing it, just to test the market. And they say, well, this is actually very good. Why don't you develop this with us? You know, this is our business developer. Let's see where we can go together. How wise is this?
It's one of those, I wish I didn't have to say it depends. And in general, I don't like the idea. It makes me nervous. In my business today, it's absolutely critical. So we have an unproven solar technology that we have proven at very small scale, but the way the business works to finance very large power plant projects are hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, and the people who make those kinds of investments don't really like technology risk. So we have to get through the technology risk phase, and the way you get through that is you have multiple installations of your power plants for years. So wait a second, how do you get the capital to do that when this is infrastructure type investment? When venture capital doesn't like the small long-term cash flows from a power plant, they like very high returns on exits of companies. So it puts us in a real bind because we can't get enough capital from venture capital to fund this period going from kind of proof of concept to elimination of technology risk. So what we have to do is team up with partners who are willing to take that risk. And that risk means they are co-developing. They are a part of what we're doing and helping us through that. And, you know, it's a dangerous spot to be. Don't like it.
As I said, Bob, you're forced into that because of the nature of your business.
That's right.
In general, you wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not fun.
Yeah, I have a strong negative bias against that because it can be seductive because it looks like it can be an accelerator and legitimizer, but... our shortcut, but it's not. In market success on your own as a starting point, I think is critical.
It's better to go raise the money from the VCs or the angel community and get that out there. There's all kinds of issues with IP entanglement and direction, and you just, you know, if you can avoid it, you actually don't have a choice. But
yeah, that's
if
true.
If anyone has any ideas that would give me another choice, I'm
so you'd prefer to do that. I think we have time for one or two more questions. Yes?
I had a question, not with the 800-pound gorilla, but with in order to get into the Japanese market, for example, you need to co-develop with a Japanese partner generally, or in some other countries. Getting to Europe, if you're an American company, same thing. How do you look at that, and what are the pluses and the minuses of co-development in order to get into Japanese company, Japanese market? Procter & Gamble, for example, has done very well co-developing with the Japanese because it's improved the product beyond what the product would have been in America. So there is an upside, and I know it all depends on the industry, but given where people are here, is it wise to look for a co-developer in a foreign market so that you get access to that market as well as perhaps government support that the Japanese might provide that you certainly wouldn't get in Europe or in America?
So the question is it wise, when you're trying to break into a new market, is it wise to look for a co-developer as a partner to get into that market?
From a foreign market in which you get access to that market and access to additional capital.
Who would like to take that?
I'll give it a crack. If you look at another market where you have cultural, social, political, language, currency, on and on, food, there's so many barriers. So depending on your product and what you're doing, if it's a commodity like wheat or something, it's not so critical, but maybe even still. But if it's something that requires integration, trying to do that without feet on the ground there is probably not going to work. So then the question is, how do you get that? Do you establish your own base? Do you partner? Do you just go at it? And I think, at least in my experience, the partnership is, in that case, kind of on a distribution and development of product for that is the way to go.
And the implicit assumption in that, just to kind of expand that question, is that you've had success in a market. And so that's really the key prerequisite. I think we're probably... Was there anybody else who had a question that didn't get called on? You can take one more. Yes?
What do you think of non-disclosure agreements? Are they better for the incumbent or for the startup? And at what point do you get started on doing an NDA place?
So the question is, are NDAs better for the incumbent or the startup, and are they a good idea? Who's got any
I can
thoughts?
Tell you who'll have the better lawyers. The incumbent's going to have a lot better lawyers, so you better know what you're signing.
Well, remember, too, that NDAs come in different flavors. There's mutual NDAs.
Right.
And there's one-way NDAs. and it's one way in either direction. So it kind of depends on what it is you're doing.
And what the incumbent's going to tell you is, hey, those damn lawyers, I can't talk to you unless you sign this. And you can't change a word on it. That's going to be their starting position. And for a lot of incumbents, when you read that non-disclosure agreement, it's a one-sided agreement. So
it basically gives all of your intellectual property to them forever, as far as
I have a jaded view of NDAs, in that they're typically non-binding. And so really what they do is they're just a way of bringing attention to kind of creating a mindfulness that the information being shared is sensitive, because legally they don't have much teeth at all. It's just a way of bringing awareness to, now we're talking about something that's my jaded view of them.
I think mutual NDAs are a little bit more dangerous, because you can actually have,
yes,
if your
right.
product is successful, you can have,
yes,
the person that you sign that mutual NDA, that's sort of in that space that you're in, reach back and say, well, you got this
from
intellectual
us.
Property from us. And it, of course, they only do that if you're successful. So
there's also a danger. You've got to actually read them. They're not some standard document. Oh, you know, our lawyers, they, you know, read them, because in some cases you'll read one and it basically says that if you reveal something and later you don't request in writing that be returned to you, you may have yielded the ownership of that. So there's some things in there that can really, you know, be scary.
That's a good point.
I'd also say it, at some level, will depend on the type of relationship or partnership you're seeking, right? I mean, if it's more or less a commercial type of agreement, you might have less sort of concerns over what is in the NDA. If you start disclosing IP, then I would read it three times and then read it three more times, you know, and make sure that it's something that you're comfortable with.
Okay, well, we're a few minutes past, so I'd like to thank our panelists, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good job.